From WIPR, I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. Fifty years ago, nine Catholic activists catapulted the suburb of Catonsville, Maryland, into the national spotlight. They burst into a Selective Service office, seized draft records, and torched them with napalm to protest the war in Vietnam. We meet two support activists who assisted the nine and discuss the tie between their faith and their activism. And we hear about the Maryland Historical Society's exhibit, Activism and Art, the Catonsville Nine, 50 years later, from curator Joe Tropea.
Within less than a five-year period, they figured out how to not only attack the draft, but end the draft. And that, to me, is one of the most successful acts of political civil disobedience in American history.
It's On the Record after the news.
You're listening to On the Record, the podcast, a service of your public radio, 88.1 WYPR. Find more podcasts online at wypr.org. And tell us what you think. Send an email to ontherecord@wypr.org.
Good morning, I'm Sheila Cast. We're On the Record. 50 years ago this month, May 17th, 1968, the fiery civil disobedience of nine Catholic activists catapulted the small suburb of Catonsville, Maryland, into the national spotlight. The men and women burst into a Selective Service office, seized hundreds of draft records, and torched them with napalm in protest of U.S. involvement in the Vietnam War. Later in the show, we'll hear from a Maryland Historical Society curator about the upcoming exhibit commemorating the event's anniversary. But joining us now are Willa Bickham and Brendan Walsh, founders of Viva House, the temporary home and soup kitchen in southwest Baltimore. It's part of a Catholic worker movement. At Viva House, they serve as many as 1,000 people a week, and it's been their focus for 50 years. Bickham and Walsh were also support activists who assisted the nine on their mission in Catonsville. And they're here with me in the studio. Welcome to On the Record.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. What is the Catholic Worker Movement?
Catholic Worker Movement was begun by Dorothy Day and Peter Morin in 1933. And the basis of the Catholic Worker is hospitality and resistance, to do the works of mercy, to feed the hungry, to visit the imprisoned, to shelter the homeless, and on the other hand, to resist that which makes people poor, to resist the wars and the pollution and that which makes life so much harder for the poor.
You each were on a path dedicated to ministry in the church. Willa, you in a convent, Brendan, you as a seminarian,
right,
studying
mm-hmm.
to be a priest. So let me ask you each, what changed? Why did you decide to devote your life to this kind of activism?
I changed because the community I was in Chicago, the Sisters of St. Joseph, were dedicated to teaching. And I was going to be a nurse. They knew that's what I wanted to do. But it was in the Chicago suburbs. And I really wanted to, it took me a while to figure out my life, like all of us. I wanted to live and work with the poor. So I came to Baltimore to live in the, on Madison Avenue in the St. Peter Claver neighborhood.
And Brendan, what about you?
I left precisely because of the Vietnam War. I was in the seminary, and I would have been ordained in 4 years, which is a very short time. And I had been there 2.5, or almost 2.75.
So you were getting close to
I was
ordination.
Very close. That's right. And at that time, Cardinal Spellman was pretty much, if you were ordained in New York City, he would have been your bishop. And he was extremely pro-war, pro-Vietnam. As a matter of fact, he was the military ordinariate for the United States. And I said, well, there's no way I could work with him. And then I had a lot of friends from college who had gone to Vietnam and some had come back in body bags. So when you're in the seminary, you have a deferment, a 4D deferment, which means that you can't be drafted. And I said, well, I'm not going to hide behind that. And when I left the seminary, I was 1A, which means you're all set for Vietnam after your physical. Well, I went for the physical, but I said I was a conscientious objector, and I'm not going to go to Vietnam, and I'm not going to serve as a medic. And you go through a pretty long process, And then you get grilled by, I was grilled by four lawyers trying to say that the Catholic Church is not a peace church. So I said, well, people who are Catholics can be peace people, and I'm one of them. And so I said, well, nobody else in the Bronx who's a Catholic has done this. I don't really believe that. But I said, well, it's up to you. I'm not going, so you could send me to jail or give me alternative service. And so after a few months, I got a notice that I was going to be 1-0. When you're 1-0, that means you have to get a job at least 200 miles from your hometown. That's kind of a service-type job. So I got a job at Johns Hopkins Hospital working in the psychiatric clinic, Phipps Clinic.
And then you two met after you were each in Baltimore.
Yes, that's right.
How were you connected to the Catonsville Nine?
Well, I had had Dan Berrigan as a theology teacher at Lemoyne when I was in college.
Father Daniel Berrigan, one of the most famous of the Catonsville Nine.
Right. And and when I left the seminary, I had been in touch with Dan the whole time I was in the seminary. I said, do you know anything good going on? And he said, well, his brother, Phil, was down here in Baltimore. And he was organizing block clubs and stuff like that in the Peter Claver neighborhood, or the Freddie Gray neighborhood for most people who don't know. And he was also working hard about the Vietnam War. So I was down here. I left the seminary in February. I was down here in March and immediately started working with the Baltimore Interfaith Peace Mission. And in the peace mission was Phil Berrigan, Tom Lewis, and Dave Eberhardt. People who I would learn, you know, we'd learn later were involved in anti-war actions like Catonsville or like the Baltimore Four.
The Baltimore Four was a protest, an action in 1967 where blood was poured on
that's right. Records.
And Dave Eberhardt was part of that.
Right. And yes. And the records were at the Customs House downtown where all of the city records were held. And so it's a little bit more difficult place to negotiate because it's, you know, it's a bigger place and everything like that. So they did that in October, and then in May of 68, they planned and located what we would call a sitting duck, which was the one in Catonsville. It was on the second floor of a Knights of Columbus building. So once again, you see the state kind of in bed with the church.
But you call it the Catonsville draft office a sitting duck because it was so approachable.
So approachable, right? It was Tom Lewis, one of the Catonsville Nine, had gone in several times to arrange a possible wedding for himself using a Knights of Columbus hall. And when you go into the draft, well, you could find where the 1A files are held if you stand there, you know, looking around and stuff like that.
This is On the Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cass speaking with Brendan Walsh and Willa Bickham, founders of Viva House. We're talking about the 50th anniversary of the Catonsville Nine, Catholic activists who protested the Vietnam War by burning hundreds of draft files. So take us back. How did you support the Catonsville Nine? What were you doing? What was it like?
On the day of Catonsville Nine, Brendan drove one of the cars, the St. Peter Claver car with the Catonsville, not some of the Catonsville Nine in it. And I was away from the building and got word when they had completed the reaction to begin the publicity. We had a press packet. And now the important thing for young people, especially when we talk about this, is to keep in mind there were no backup records, no computers. So there was no other record.
The paper records were the record they had on each young
man.
Yeah,
that was it.
That was all. And so when we did our press release, we had to go. We had to go downtown to the Sun Papers, the Afro-American. We went to the UPI, AP, Daily Record. We had to do that, plus then go down to D.C. because you had to hand deliver. There are no faxes. No computers. So we did the whole big press release and were contacts for that.
And you had not let the press know in advance that this was going to happen?
First, I didn't end up driving the car. Phil took the keys from me and he drove the car. I just got it back to Peter Claver's. But the important
thing
is...
Because he was so nervous, yeah.
So, and then, no, Phil wanted to get there. We had gotten in touch with a reporter from Channel 11 then, Patrick McGrath. He only knew that he would meet us at a certain place and then he would follow us to Catonsville. So when he got there, he didn't know why he was there at all, and said, well, just go around back. And he was running, because I had been waiting in the back to let the people in the library know that it had taken place. The records are out there. And so Patrick got back there. He got back there in time to see them dump the trash container on the ground, and then they burned it with homemade napalm.
The trial of the Catonsville Nine was a big national story. Tell us what it was like being in Baltimore supporting the Catonsville Nine while the trial was going on.
The trial was October of 68, and during the five-day trial, we had a lot of the families of the Catonsville Nine staying with us at Viva House. Dorothy Day, who is the co-founder of our movement, stayed with us, and we had rallies, gatherings each night at St. Ignatius Church. And of course, us being in the hospitality, doing the soup kitchen and all, we did most of the cooking for that. And there were hundreds and hundreds of people. And there were people during the talks that were given that would burn their draft card. There was a lot going on during the evening sessions of the trial.
I think it was one of the first times I had seen the police in full riot gear. The police thought there was going to be violence, and there was no violence. It was completely nonviolent demonstration, but a lot of people. We marched down Howard Street from Wyman Park and into it used to be the old post office building is where the trial was held. That was where federal court was then. And we also had a big group in the plaza in front of City Hall.
You are also co-authors of a book, The Long Loneliness in Baltimore, Stories Along the Way, which is a compilation of poems and essays about your 50 years at Viva House. Tell us a bit more about Viva House. Yeah. It's located near Union Square.
We were both working here in Baltimore, you know, around Peter Claver. Willa was working with a place called Joseph House. And I was working with Phil with the Interfaith Peace Mission. So we actually met at Peter Claver's. We really met in August, and we got married in December of the same year.
Not too pleasing to our parents.
And it ended up a good friend from Lemoyne, Dave Miller, and he had started a Catholic worker house in Washington. So I said, well, I'll give you a hand, Dave. And then Willa, although she says that she was going to go on her own, followed me down there. So anyway, we worked. But our goal was, after we got married, was to come back to Baltimore and begin a house ourselves. And we began in 1968. And over the years, we've probably provided shelter for maybe 1,300 women and children. And we've really stopped counting real clearly, but we've served over a million meals. And in addition to serving the meals, we do a food pantry where people take home a three-day supply of food that they cook themselves.
Well, congratulations on five-plus decades of living your values. Thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome.
Brendan Walsh and Willa Bickham, founders of Viva House, part of the Catholic Worker Movement, a hospitality house and soup kitchen. 50 years ago, they were part of the support network for the Catonsville Nine, Catholic activists who torched hundreds of draft files to protest the Vietnam War. Their book, The Long Loneliness in Baltimore, Stories Along the Way, is a compilation of poems and essays about 50 years of their experiences at Viva House. Quick break now on the record. Then we'll ask a Maryland Historical Society curator about the upcoming exhibit, Activism and Art, the Catonsville Nine, 50 Years Later. I'm Sheila Cast. Stay with us.
God of the poor man, this is how the day began. A co-defendant sighed, Daniel Bear again. Oh, and only a layman. Batch of napalm. We pulled the draft files out. We burned them in the parking lot. Better the files than the bodies of children. They had no right to
This is the On the Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member-supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR. Become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link.
Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking today about the Catonsville Nine, Catholic activists who destroyed hundreds of draft files in protest of the Vietnam War. We spoke earlier with Brendan Walsh and Willa Bickham, who were part of the support network for that action. Joining us now is Maryland Historical Society curator of films and photographs, Joe Tropea, to tell us about the upcoming exhibit, Activism and Art, the Catonsville Nine, 50 Years Later, which opens May 12th, next Saturday. Tropea also produced the 2013 film Hit and Stay, A History of Faith and Resistance, a documentary about the Catonsville Nine and other actions. Welcome to On the Record, Joe.
Hi, Sheila. Thanks for having me in.
So this exhibit features work by Tom Lewis, who was one of the Catonsville Nine. Tell us about Tom Lewis.
Tom Lewis is a fascinating individual. He was one of the youngest members of the Catonsville Nine. He wasn't originally from Maryland. He came here from Louisville, Kentucky, where he was a high school football star. And when he came here to Baltimore, he was so good at football that he was recruited by Johnny Unitas to play for the Colts. Rather than do that, he decided once he graduated high school to go to Europe to study art for a year.
What a choice.
Yeah, and when he came back, he was sort of activated by the civil rights movement that he saw taking place in Baltimore. So he was politically activated by the civil rights movement.
And then how did he get connected with the Catonsville Nine?
Well, he was in the Interfaith Peace Mission along with Phil Berrigan, that I think Brendan Walsh was telling you about. But this was an organization in Baltimore that brought together people of several different faiths to try to figure out how to stand in opposition against the Vietnam War. And I think from hanging out with Phil, from what I've heard of Phil, he was a very charismatic individual, and he was kind of brought into doing the action by Phil Berrigan.
So tell us about Tom Lewis's art. What does it depict?
So it depicts he did etchings and screen printing, and our show is comprised of his pieces that depict why he did action in Catonsville, scenes from Vietnam and protest in the United States, and then it also depicts his prison experience, which were the consequences of his action in Catonsville. So it's a pretty well-rounded show as far as learning the context of Catonsville, why someone would do such a thing, and what it was like to pay the price for having done it.
How much time did he spend in prison, do you know?
I believe he was there less than 3 years. I haven't memorized the jail sentences, unfortunately, but yeah.
How did the Historical Society acquire his work?
We acquired his work from a man named Larry Kamenetz. Yes, he's related to that Kamenetz, who donated...
The county executive of Baltimore County.
Yeah, he donated his collection that he obtained from another activist. So Lewis's art was sort of passed down from activist to activist and collected by people politically minded. And we acquired them that way.
That's Joe Tropea, Maryland Historical Society curator of films and photographs, here on the Record on WIP. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about the exhibit Activism and Art, the Catonsville Nine, 50 Years Later, which opens a week from Saturday, May 12th. Walk us through what else visitors can expect at the exhibit.
Well, in addition to Tom Lewis's artwork, you will see a video component, which is comprised of scenes from the documentary I did in 2013 with my co-director, Skiz Sizek. So there'll be scenes from Hit and Stay, sort of adding context to the visuals that you're staring at. And in addition to that, we will have a wall that sort of interprets where the different nine activists came from. And long story short, they came from all over the world with several motivations that compelled them to act in Catonsville.
Several motivations.
Yes, for instance, three of them, the Melvilles and John Hogan, were missionaries in Guatemala, where they saw firsthand U.S. policy in action. They were expelled from Guatemala for getting too close to what the government deemed communist guerrillas, which in reality meant farmers who basically wanted to be able to work their own land. So they were expelled from Guatemala. And their motivation for Catonsville, as much as Vietnam was one of the reasons, but they also wanted to highlight what was happening in places like Guatemala.
The Catonsville Nine action took place before social media even existed, but the impact of it spread pretty quickly throughout the country. It triggered other acts of civil disobedience. Why do you think it resounded so?
I think because they knew what they were doing. They were savvy enough to invite the press, but they did it in a way to keep the press from getting implicated in the activity. But they made sure that there were people there to take photographs and to shoot film of the action. And then they, as Willa described earlier, they publicized what they did, and they dropped the press releases the second the action had successfully taken place. So in lieu of, having Twitter or Facebook to publicize what they did, they just had a well-thought-out plan to make sure every major newspaper in the nation knew about what they were going to do and why they did it.
Well, and as a filmmaker, not just newspapers, but how could you have made Hit and Stay if they had not gotten Patrick McGrath and his camera crew there to film the action?
It would have been very difficult, and there would have been more boring talking heads.
The talking heads in Hit and Stay are not boring. The documentary runs from the Baltimore 4 action, the Blood on the Files in 67, through the Catonsville 9, through a lot of other actions, ending with the Camden, New Jersey 28. What year was that?
That was in 1972, I believe, without having my notes in front of me.
And they were acquitted.
They were acquitted. So they were not the last action to happen, but they were the first successful subsequent action to do what the Catonsville Nine did, which was do an action, admit their guilt, and try to get a jury to nullify a decision and say that what they did was justified. So by the time Camden 28 happened, they were successful. The jury found them not guilty, and they were free, of all their charges.
Late in your film, Hit and Stay, someone asks, if the anti-war movement didn't stop the Vietnam War, what did it do? As a filmmaker, how do you answer that?
Well, the thing that stands out about what the Catonsville Nine did for me is that within less than a five-year period, they figured out how to not only attack the draft, but end the draft. And that, to me, is one of the most successful acts of political civil disobedience in American history, as far as I can tell.
Because the U.S. went to an all-volunteer army in, what, 1972?
In 1973, I think Nixon, or maybe it was Ford, finally signed the paperwork on ending the draft. So, yeah, that's a hugely successful outcome, I think.
Other repercussions that we feel today?
Well, of course, the government adapts, and they figured out a way around the draft through, other means, by economic hardship. So I think we feel the ramifications of that. And certainly the U.S. government has not changed its policies on intervening to the negative, in my opinion, in foreign nations. So there are those repercussions.
Joe, thank you.
Thank you, Sheila.
Maryland Historical Society curator and filmmaker Joe Tropea speaking about the Historical Society exhibit Activism and Art, the Catonsville Nine, 50 years later. Earlier, we spoke with Brendan Walsh and Willa Bickham, founders of Viva House. We're talking about the 50th anniversary of the Catonsville Nine, activists who destroyed hundreds of draft files in protest of the Vietnam War in May 1968. There's an array of events planned to commemorate the 50th anniversary of the Catonsville Nine, starting with a symposium tomorrow at UMBC and Commemoration Day Saturday in Catonsville. We have links to information about the events at the On the Record page at WYPR.org. The Historical Society exhibit opens a week from Saturday, May 12th. This is On the Record. I'm Sheila Cass. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow.
Thanks for listening to this segment of On the Record with Sheila Cast. You can catch the show on the radio Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 10 a.m. on 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station. And you can support On the Record and all the other public radio programs that WYPR brings to you. Just click the donate link at the top of WYPR.org. And thanks.